Well, thank you. As they say, after that introduction, I can't wait to hear what I'm going to say to you. Before I start, I've got about 60 slides and we've got about 60 minutes, and my normal delivery is one slide per minute, so you'll be all right. We will get to the wine on time. But notwithstanding that, could you interrupt if anything's not clear? Because I'm anxious that I give you something useful as well as that which I thought you might like to know. So please do interrupt if something needs clarifying, and I'll catch up the time and we will get to the wine in time. So you've already heard my CV. I started off as a physicist and soon found that there was no money in physics, so I went into business. I ran some companies for 7 years. I then got fired. We're talking about managing people, managing teams. I was the managing director of a PLC. Fighting with the chairman in board meetings is a really bad idea if you want to promote a successful management career. So I got fired. I was then unemployed, or a consultant, as we call them in Oxford. And I met some rich guys who wanted to invest in technology-based businesses. And we started a couple. Oxford Asymmetry was sold for $300 million. The university made $11 million for a cash investment of zero. They thought this was a good idea. So they recruited me to build up ISIS Innovation so they could have more spin-outs. And that's what I did for 10 years. After I'd retired from there, I joined a couple of companies as a non-exec. So you can see I started my life in industry, dabbled in finance, dabbled in academia, and now I'm sort of back in industry as well. So it really achieved nothing going around all this pain and anguish. But this will explain to you some of my prejudices. Now, I'm supposed to be talking to you about managing people, managing teams. And the first thing, the first point to make is it really matters. Everything that's done in the company is done by a person, and if you're not going to do it all yourself, you need to be getting good at getting other people to do what you want them to do, which may well not be what they want to do. I've seen more companies fail through lack of cohesion than any other cause. I mean, sometimes the market fails, sometimes the technology fails, but with a great market and a great technology, incompetent management can wreck a huge amount of shareholder value. And that being so, I think it's probably worth spending an evening thinking about this stuff. When the going gets tough, you don't want to have to start building relationships with the people you work with. Very early in my career, the first managing director job I had was for one of the subsidiaries of one of the companies in the Oxford Instruments Group. And a colleague of mine was the managing director of Oxford Medical Systems, which was based in Abingdon, but had a subsidiary in Florida, run by an American called Jack Frost. And my friend and the head of the American subsidiary used to meet once a month, either in the UK or in the States. And this seemed to me a terrible waste of money on transatlantic airfares. And I said to my friend, why do you do this? And he said, well, it's important for us to communicate with each other when we're not having problems, so that when we are having problems, the communication's already open. He said, it's a bit like a concert pianist. Concert pianists spend a long time playing the piano when nobody's listening, so that when people are listening, it all comes out right. And I think this is a theme through my talk, really. If you communicate when you're not under stress, when you are under stress, at least you've got viable communication channels open. So if you're going to run a business, if you're going to manage a piece of a business, see this as an important part of the job, not a personal characteristic of you as a manager, but as a professional skill that if you're good at, your life will be easier and more successful. So it's a professional skill. Many managers never get themselves any training in this subject. They think they can make it up. It's a major risk if you get it wrong, as I demonstrated in my own career when I got fired from Microlec. So transactional analysis is a way of looking and structuring the interaction between two people. I've just spent 10 weeks on a part-time course on this. You can spend 4 years covering this. I'm going to tell you about it in about 4 minutes. So this will be a superficial presentation, but if you're interested in it, it's worth looking. The idea is that each of us can operate in one of three ego states. These are conveniently labelled parent, adult, and child. When we're operating in a parent state, we are supporting, we are using our experience, and we have some pat responses we give people. When we're operating in adult, it's all about data processing, facts, reporting back, asking for reports back. And, of course, the resulting gratification of being adult about things. And finally, when we're behaving in child, it's all about intuition, creativity, spontaneity, having fun, enjoyment. None of these are more important than the others. They're equally respectable, and we all do all of them. Some people do some more than others. And these, on the standard transactional analysis diagram, these are shown as three blobs. Now, if we initiate an interaction with someone, we'll label ourselves as the agent, and they can label them as the respondent. Let's look what happens. So I say something to you, and you respond. A stimulus and a response. This is all pretty straightforward, but it gets quite complex in a minute. So let's look at a transaction. I arrive at Oxford Railway Station, and there's someone in the booking hall sitting on a seat, sobbing. I walk up to this person and say, "Is there anything I can do to help?" They say, "Yes, I've just had some really bad news, and I've got to get home to Birmingham, and I don't know what time the train is, and I'm very distraught about it." So this is me taking a parent role, inviting them to respond in a child role. In other words, I'm saying, "I've got the power, can I use my power to help your problem?" And this is called a complementary transaction, and it's all very comfortable because I can go and look up the train times and help them, and they'll feel cared for, and I'll feel smug, and that'll be a complementary transaction. So that's nice. Let us now look at what can go wrong, and this is called a cross transaction. Same scenario, I go and say, "Can I do anything to help?" They stand up, smack me on the nose and say, "Who the hell do you think you are coming interfering in my life?" In other words, they're telling me what I'm doing wrong, so they're being parent, I'm being parent, and there's a lot of pain involved. You see this all the time, but this is a cross-transaction, and the only way out of it is for one or other of us, well, we can either separate and break the transaction off, or for one or other of us to change roles. For example, I could move into an adult role and say, "I'm terribly sorry, I just..." and then I start reporting, which is a characteristic of adult behaviour. "I wanted to help, but if you're fine, I'll go away and I apologise for disturbing you." And they say, "Well, actually, no, I did..." And then they can go adult and say, "I did overreact a bit, but perhaps you could just give me a hand lifting this big heavy case onto the platform." So that's the basis of transactional analysis. Now, there's a lot more to it than that. The important point, I think, is that each of these three aspects is entitled to equal respect and has a legitimate place in life. So if you're always childish, you shouldn't feel bad about it. You may be a creative genius. This was the system was initiated by Eric Byrne in 1964, and there's a couple more books here, one by him, one by someone else. This word "joins" is not a typing error. He really is called Van Joins. So if you're interested in that, that's all I want to tell you about transactional analysis. Let's now get on to leadership styles. I'm still talking, as I was last time, about one-to-one relationships. We'll do one-to-many later on. If you look at the ways leaders can operate, you could characterise it in two orthogonal dimensions. So you could say, how supportive are they? In other words, do they care what you, the people being led, think? And the other is, how directive are they? Do they tell you what to do, or do they trust you? And if you define four styles of leadership around this, sector one, sector two, sector three, sector four, they're sometimes called type one, type two, type three, type four. If we just look at bottom left-hand corner, type one leadership, highly directive, low supportive. If I smell smoke, I will tell you to get out of the lecture room quickly using the doors at the back. I don't want a discussion, I want you out now. That's type one leadership. That's the way you work when you've got subordinates whose capabilities you're not sure about. And similarly, you can go round the chart. Now, You can describe these four styles as directing, coaching, supporting, and delegating. And with different members of your team, you may have to use different styles. The important thing is that as you go round the chart, you don't want to miss out any steps. And the progress you make, if you define progress as moving from right to left, depends on the stage of the development of the people that you're trying to manage, or the person you're trying to manage. And, of course, your skill. I will assume that having been on this course, you will all be supremely skilled. Not all members of your team will be at the same stage. They never are. You may well have people in your team who are very unself-confident and who really do need you to tell them what to do every half day or so. There may well be members of your team who are so good at what they do and know you so well and who you trust so well that you just see them once a month when they come over from the States and they get on with doing what they do. So different members of the team can be at a different stage. But as you and your team progress, you and the individuals in your team progress, it is dangerous to miss out a stage. For example, if you've been working with someone who works for you and you've been directing them, and you suddenly start delegating stuff for them, it may well be a symptom of you just having got fed up of telling them what to do, and you're not delegating, you're abdicating. What's more, they will probably, well, if you're lucky, they might lift up the baton, but on the other hand, they may just collapse under the strain. Similarly, if you've been supporting someone, and if you're in Sector 3, and you suddenly start telling them what to do, they will be very demotivated because they've been used to low direction from you and high support, and suddenly they're getting strong direction and no support. And jumping straight from coaching to delegating may also destroy confidence because, you know, suddenly I've got no support anymore. Doesn't my boss love me? So you can make up your own examples, but it is important, I think, to know where each of your team are in their relations to you on this chart and take it step by step. And, of course, you can go both ways. If someone's struggling, you may need to move back a notch until their self-confidence gets going. Let's look at the variables in these relationships. The first one is the self-confidence of the person who's working for you. The second is your confidence in them. The third one is their confidence in you. And, of course, your confidence in yourself. Now, I will assume, for the purposes of this course, that everybody's full of self-confidence and they enjoy the confidence of their subordinates. This is not, of course, always the case, but it suffices to make that assumption for the illustration that follows. As the relationship moves around the chart, it's interesting to look how the other two vary, the other two being the subordinate self-confidence and your confidence in them. So we start in directing. Your confidence in them is low, and their self-confidence is low, and you tell them what to do, and they feel cared for, and you feel in control of the business. And then, as you move around the chart, your confidence in them increases, and hopefully their self-confidence increases as well, so they become more and more autonomous as your relationship progresses. And that's great while it's all going well. But let's look what happens when it goes the other way. Assuming you've got someone who works for you, and you've been delegating to them, and you've given them objectives every 4 months, and they've been delivering the goods, and if they've had problems, they've asked for help, but most of the time they're good. And their work starts to fall off for whatever reason, maybe a work-related reason, maybe a non-work-related reason. Then your confidence in them starts reducing, but we have no idea what's happening to their self-confidence. They may still feel they're doing a great job, but you know they're not. This is really tricky, and unless you can actually find time to sit and watch this relationship, you only find out about this when there's a huge crisis. And what I'm hoping to do is sensitise you to it so you see it before there's much blood. There's one other aspect of this that I should mention, and that is hysteresis. This little man pulling his truck of gold walks in a path like that. And let's look what the truck does. The truck goes to the left until he turns around and the string goes slack. Then the truck stops for a bit until the string's gone tight the other way, and then the truck moves back the other way. The two important things to note about this is, one, there is a lag in the reaction of the truck to the change of direction of the little man. And so there will be with your people. If you change what you want to do, you should not assume that the whole team is going to change direction on a sixpence, because it won't. First thing is, they have to work out what it is you wanted them to do. Then they have to stop doing things the way they did it before. Then they have to start doing it the way you want to do it. If you change direction sufficiently rapidly, they won't ever change at all. They'll just take the average of what they thought you wanted. The other thing to note is that the truck doesn't move with the same amplitude as the little man, and that's also the case with physical things, but may not be the case with people. If you've got your team dynamics right, you may get a much bigger energy from the response that you actually put in the stimulus, and that's what makes it all worthwhile. So that's enough about leadership and management. Let's now look at selection techniques, because a good way of successfully leading a team is to have a successful team. My colleague Tom Hockaday, who some of you may have met, who now runs ISIS, is one for the bon mots. And one of his bon mots is that good people do good work. So when you see a piece of work that is really competently done, surprise, surprise, it's done by a supremely competent person. Hockaday's second edict is equally illuminating, and that is that prats beget prats. If you meet an idiot and then you go and meet his or her boss, it turns out the boss is one as well, because who would employ an idiot? So good people do good work. So therefore, if you can select and assemble a winning team, your lives will be a lot easier. So let me talk a bit about selection techniques, and specifically I'm going to talk about interviews, psychometrics and networks. I mean, again, there's probably a two-year course you can do on selection techniques. This is the 10-minute version. So a bit about interviews. I've interviewed lots of people. I've been interviewed by lots of people. I've watched lots of interviews. And the first thing is to give you the health warning. You must avoid prejudice with respect to age, gender, sexual preference or race. Some people suggest that you should ask the same question to every candidate. I have been in organisations where I've been issued with a list of questions and you're not allowed to ask any other questions. This is the law, and it doesn't work for an interviewing situation, I don't believe. So I'm not going to advise you to break the law, but I'm going to advise you to think rather than following strictly laid down rules, because what you want to do is find out as much about the candidate as you possibly can. My approach is to ask factual rather than hypothetical questions, but always with an eye to the green stuff at the top. So before the interview, and this is obvious, study the advert and the job description you've written. I've been to interviews where I've seen the interviewer leafing through the job description on their desk while interviewing me. This is not good. So you may well have written the job description 3 months ago, or HR may have written the job description, but bear in mind that the person who's come for the interview will have been reading this document all the way on the train as they came, so they will know what's in it, and you really need to know at least as much as they do about the job that you're interviewing them for. Really read their application before the interview day. I've seen managers who said, oh, I'm on my way to some interviews now and I've not had time to read the CVs. This is stupid, because A, it's rude to the people you're trying to recruit, and B, you may well recruit the wrong person. What I like to do is to look up their name and previous employers on the web. You might even resort to Facebook. Don't forget, it's public information, so you're allowed to know it. Compare the facts in the application with what you've asked for. When I'm applying for a job or when I'm recruiting for a job, I make a list of the key points. And then I put down, if I'm applying for a job, how I meet all their requirements. And if I'm recruiting, I look for how they meet all my requirements. And just compare the facts. If there's a mismatch, it's not necessarily a no-no if the candidate has addressed it. Note it as a discussion point. So, for example, if you've put in the job description, we're looking for 3 years in a senior management position, and the candidate hasn't got 3 years in a senior management position, but you've still, for some reason, decided to interview them. investigate whether they've thought about it. Because it may be, well, no, I haven't had 3 years in a senior management position, but I did actually start my own business and sold this lot of stuff. So although I didn't have any staff, I do actually understand the basics of profit and loss and cash flow. So look for the mismatch, but don't say wrong if they've addressed it. Look for gaps in the CV. This, particularly if you're recruiting senior people, there's a standard trick in CV writing that if you've been to prison for a year, you don't put it on your CV. You say, you know, I was with such and such a company till 1997, and then from 2000 I was with this company. Now, if you see that all in text, it's difficult to do. So what I do with complex CVs, I actually put them on a spreadsheet. This is my CV. The left-hand side are the jobs I've had, and the right-hand side is the training I've had, roughly. Now, I'm not suggesting you go to this multicoloured level with everybody you interview, but if you've got someone who's had 10 jobs for a senior job, if you put this in, there'll be a white bit where they were in prison. So it's sometimes worth going to this level of effort for a complicated CV and a senior job. When you're interviewing people, it's better if there's more than one of you, for several reasons. One, it's much easier to observe what's going on if you're not interacting at the time. It's important that you decide in advance with your colleague what it is you want to know. In other words, which bit of the CV do we want to dig into, or which bit of the job do we really want to talk about? Decide with your colleague who will cover what. It's really bad manners to steal other people's questions. So I would suggest that for this exercise you use a pro forma. This is the one I use. Design it yourself. Fill in as much as you can in advance. I have name at the top, and I always write the first name of the candidate in large block capitals there. It's really embarrassing when you're interviewing someone if you forget their name. So if it's at the top right-hand corner, so your eyes don't have to go down very far, you can address them by name. Personality and appearance is already getting a bit iffy from the legal point of view, because on the other hand, if it's a job where personality and appearance is a key requirement, then I think it's allowable. I put down under education and career progression most recent first, so I'll put year, company, what they did, and the rest I fill in as the interview proceeds. But before we start the interview, under questions, I'll have two or three words for each question and who's going to ask it. So fill in as much as you can in advance. You don't have to fill it in sequence. As bits come out in the conversation, particularly if there's two of you, your colleague can draw the fire while you write something down on here. Identify the order of questions and who asks what. Don't write stuff you may regret. Sometimes if you're in a problematical interview with a really dull person, you can make yourself feel better by writing down, this guy is very boring. And it may amuse your colleague who's sitting next to you. This is a really bad idea, because if they don't get the job, and if they then sue you, this document may well be disclosable in a court of law. And your side doesn't look very good if you're writing that sort of thing down on the interview. So just bear in mind, this piece of paper may well be read by someone who doesn't like you. So that then brings us on to what to ask and what not to ask. I am not from the confrontational school of interviewing. I like to start with an easy one about their CV. It's usually, can you expand on this bit? It's not a pressurised thing. It gets them going. Always ask factual questions, because people are much, much less likely to exaggerate or lie about facts. So if you say, would you say you were a competent sales manager, what they're going to answer? If you say, what's the biggest sales team you've ever managed, they might stretch it a bit, but they won't lie outright. Don't ask hypothetical questions. Do you think you can manage a team like the one we have? What are they going to say? Don't tell them the answer in advance. We are looking for someone bright and entrepreneurial. How would you describe yourself? And so they'll pretend to think, say, well, I think I'm quite bright and entrepreneurial. Yeah. I mean, these are all real. But one of the do things is ask open questions. When your brain's getting a bit jumbled in the middle of one of these things, remember the two words, tell me. Because if you say, tell me about, and then anything on the piece of paper in front of you, that gets you off the hook and gives you time to recover your presence of mind. But then, whilst they're telling you about whatever it was you've asked them, ask them to expand on it. So, how successful was it? Oh, the turnover shot up. But look for facts in the answer. What was the turnover before and what was the turnover afterwards? Oh, it was £3 and then it was £5. No, that's not what we're looking for. If it was £3 million, then it was... And when you say it was £5 million, was that in your section? Oh, no, that was the company's turnover. There was another product that was nothing to do with me. So all the time, facts are much more difficult to exaggerate. And how, why, what and when, not questions with a yes-no answer. Did you think this was successful? Yes. What? By how much did you increase the turnover? This is controversial because some people think that people should really be put under pressure at interviews. I don't think you get a realistic assessment of people under pressure. I think they have a much more realistic performance if they're enjoying it. I'm not suggesting you should have drinks and nibbles and everything, but I think if you're trying to develop a relationship with this person who might be working for you, this is a good time to start. You're selling the job to them, so don't be nasty. Most people don't want to work for a nasty boss. Now, why are you selling the job to them? Because if this is the candidate you want, you don't want them to think, oh, I don't want to work for him, he's nasty. Don't argue with your colleague in front of interviewees. Most people don't want to join a disunited team. I was in a meeting with some lawyers who were pitching for our business, and two of them had an argument. This was when we were recruiting lawyers to work for ISIS, patent attorneys to work for ISIS, and they just disagreed, and the ISIS team were just sitting there watching these two clowns putting each other down. So don't argue with a colleague. I mean, if you must argue with your colleague, do it after they've left. You say, I didn't really agree with what you said about that, but not in front of the interviewees. Assume they will be nervous. I mean, we're all nervous when we go for interviews, unless we're particularly thick-skinned. And they may well behave non-typically. They may be too smiley, too giggly, too shaky, too silent. So help them to settle and don't jump to conclusions. After the interview, immediately review your notes. It's very easy at the end of a long day of interviewing to slam your bag shut, jump on the train and think, I'll look at it tomorrow. But then you get in the office tomorrow and there's something urgent and it gets through to lunchtime. You think, oh, I really must look at that interview. By this time, your colleague's flown back to Canada. So you're then conferring with him by cell phone and it doesn't work. So immediately review your notes. Confer with the colleague, if you've got one, on what you've learned. Different people see different things in interviews, and getting as soon as you've had the interview is a good idea. Review with your colleague how you did. This is particularly useful if you're doing a series of interviews. Say you're doing two in the morning and two in the afternoon. After the first one, say, how did we do? And he'll say, well, I think it would be better if I talked about this and you talked about that, or perhaps we should do these two points in another order. Because you can then improve on your performance as the day progresses. Get back to candidates as soon as possible, preferably by phone, preferably yourself. This is very difficult to do if you have a punitive HR department who won't let you do any managing. But if you can do this, it shows courtesy and starts to build a working relationship with the people you're trying to recruit. If I've had an interview and the person I spoke to phones me up the next day, even if it's only to tell me that I might be on for a second interview, that's better than never hearing anything. A colleague of mine has just was made redundant some time ago, and he's been looking for jobs, and he goes for interviews and never hears anything at all. This is not only impolite, but it means that the people doing the interviewing are just not competent. So do get back to them as soon as possible, as soon as your company's rules will allow. Always, I should have underlined that, get references. So a bit about getting references. Sometimes people will only give written ones. For example, I think if you're getting references for teachers, education authorities have a rule, we never give telephone references. So you can't have one. But if you can, I prefer to phone the referee. Say who you are, what the job is, and that the candidate has nominated them. If they say, well, he never asked me, that tells you something about the candidate. But assuming that the candidate is kosher, that's all right. Ask the referee about facts, start date, end date, salary, and so on. Then you get on to the more fuzzy things. Ask about strengths. People are quite good to tell you about their ex-colleague's strengths. I don't ask about weaknesses, but I ask what advice the referee would give the new boss. And that's the same as asking about weaknesses, but it's not so much pressure on the referee. And also, the referee, it shows the referee that you care what they've got to say, because they can then go into parent. You have, going back to the transactional stuff, you have now assumed the role of child. Oh, please, can you tell me what I need to know about this person? And it's always good being parent. So they'll say, well, yes, you want to be, make sure that you give very clear instructions and don't expect them to ever do much on a Thursday morning, because he always goes out drinking on Wednesday night. So you find out about weaknesses without actually being explicit in asking for weaknesses. If you decide not to bother with references, work out in advance what you're going to say to your investors or your boss when the appointee turns out to be a con artist. In other words, always, always, always get references. Many jobs are filled from networks rather than from recruiting adverts or headhunters. Sometimes your own network will produce a candidate. Sometimes one of your mates will say, can I have the job? It is really important to try and treat them as any other candidate. If they expect to bypass the process, they're probably not right for the job, because they have not accepted that the job's in your gift. And if they're insubordinate now, what are they going to be like when they're an employee? I was running a company and was advertising for a sales and marketing manager. And a mate of mine who lived in Holland applied. And I thought he was the man for the job. Nevertheless, he went through the process. He had the interview with all the people that everyone else had interviews with. He had to fill an application form. We had a night away where all the candidates came. All of that. Now, we ended up appointing him. Now, I could have saved the headhunter fee and appointed him, but I would never have known that he was the best. And so I think this treat them as any other candidate is a really important thing to do. You will spend some money on it, and you will also avoid some errors where you then have to fire a mate, which is an unpleasant thing to have to do. Don't grab this as a low-effort, low-cost way of recruiting, unless you really do get the right person. And even then, I will get someone who isn't you, whose judgment you respect, to check it. It's much easier to hire people than to fire them. I had a chairman a long time ago who said that to me, and he's absolutely right. I have hired a lot of people. I've fired a few. It's not pleasant firing people, because it means you probably made a mistake recruiting them in the first place. It's a bit easier if someone else recruited them, but you still have all the human angst, and you never feel good about it. So don't say, we must get someone to do this job, however bad they are. A bad employee generally creates more work than they resolve. Now, another subject which you can spend your life studying is psychometrics. So again, I want to give you a taste of this, and if you are interested in it, you can do it properly later. The idea of psychometrics is they're questionnaire-based tests to parameterize, sorry about the word, personality and behavioral traits. In other words, you give someone a big list of questions, they have to tick agree, strongly agree, disagree strongly, and anything in between, and then there's an algorithm that produces a result. There are lots of different sets of psychometric tests. Myers-Briggs is probably the most famous one. That has 88 questions that you sit down and you tick boxes. And that rates you on four different axes, extroversion, introversion, and so on. It's used by some dating agencies and some recruitment agencies. I think they're fine if you use them as a way of raising questions and things to talk about in a subsequent interview. I don't think they're decision-making tools. I think they're subject-raising tools. I used to go into companies with management problems to sort them out, and I got someone to do one of these on the top team, sales director, production director, and so on. And it's quite difficult presenting the results of this back to the people, particularly to senior people. And one way to do it is to, in the subsequent interview, to say, what I can't understand is this is showing me that you have a strong something or other, and I can't understand how that's come through in the question. So I had a sales director, and he came through as argumentative on the test. So I said, I liked him, and I said, well, you know, this has come across showing that you're quite argumentative. And he actually stood up and said, no, I'm not. And then we both laughed. So it was all right. So they're good, but I don't think they're anything other than a way of getting into a conversation, because it's only in the conversation that you actually get to what you want to do. And now this has all been one-to-one stuff so far. So it said on the advert that I had to talk about teams a bit. So this is now more about one-to-many. I'm sure you all know what management is, but I'll tell you what I mean by management. A manager is given authority over some resources owned by somebody else. And the owner of the resources gives the manager authority in order to achieve an objective set by the owner. This would be news to some managers who thought they actually owned everything they were managing. So the fundamental tasks of the manager are, one, control the resources that we've been entrusted with. Two, coordinate the activities of the staff that we're responsible for so they don't fight amongst themselves. And finally, manage the boundaries between what we control and the rest of the world. So it's fairly straightforward. But looking at this with the team in mind, I'd like to divide our team into two. One, the ones we control directly, i.e. staff and the machinery and assets that we've been trusted with, and I'll call them insiders. And then there's all the members of our team that we don't actually control. So there's the advisors, the accountants, the lawyers, the bankers, the local government, all the people who you need to do stuff who you don't actually control. Of course, you can fire the outsiders if you want. I mean, companies change their accountants if the accountants don't do a good job, but it's time consuming and disruptive, so there must be a better way. And at the end of the talk, I want to talk about how you control people you don't own. There's a book came out in 1936, which is a cliche, called How to Make Friends and Influence People. If you haven't read it, you really should. I had another of my great management disasters. I was working for a company, and I was the managing director of a subsidiary, and I was called in by the board, and I lost my temper with the board because I was all hyped up for my presentation, and they just sat there, and I got no response. This was, again, not a great career-advancing move. I left the company shortly afterwards. I did actually leave that one rather than getting fired. But I went on a one-week course run by the Dale Carnegie Organisation, which was utterly brilliant. If you've not read this, read it. It's not embarrassing. I mean, you might not want to be seen reading it, so, you know, you can get it in a plain cover or something, I suppose. But it's good stuff. And it matters. It's just as relevant with employees as it is with outsiders. I mean, I've been talking about managing employees and influencing outsiders, but of course you need to influence employees as well. You can't tell everybody what you want them to do in detail, so you have to influence them so that they think the way you think. In the company, assuming it's a manufacturing company, you need people who will say what you sell, what you're going to sell, develop it, and there was obviously going to be feedback between the people developing the product or offering and the marketing department. Product development, where you're going to get it from, you're either going to buy it or make it, delivering it, particularly delivering what the customers think they've bought, collecting the money, and a leader. The leader might well not be you. I mean, I assume you're all going to be leaders of multinational companies, but if you're not, if you are someone with a vision but without any enthusiasm for executive authority, you may want to employ a leader, so don't necessarily assume it's going to be you. A couple of words about investors. You don't always need investors. Sometimes you can start a company on your overdraft and you can get it into cash generation quick enough so you don't need investors, which saves an awful lot of time spent on trying to raise investment. But when we're trying to raise investment, which most companies do, the investors will like to see a full team. And startups hardly, I would say, never have a full team. They don't have people doing all that stuff I put on the previous chart. They have two or three people, each of whom does more than one of those. It's important when you're trying to raise investment that you recognise that you haven't got a full team and you have a plan. In other words, we are subcontracting out our website management for the time being, and that's the plan. Then we're going to take it in-house in year three, and da-da-da-da-da. This is sometimes difficult because of team dynamics, because there may well be someone in the startup team who all the members of the team except this person knows are not going to make it full-time. Talking about the long-term may be problematical. I worked for a company where the chief executive was quoted in the Financial Times that he didn't think that the technical director was going to be in it for the long run. This was extremely demotivating for the technical director who read it in the paper. But on the other hand, don't wreck the business because you don't want to offend a mate. It's sometimes cruel. A bit about authority. Here's the standard company structure. Some owners, employee directors, or employee managers, or employee workers. This shows who's accountable to whom, who decides what salary people get, who gets fired, who gets hired, and so on. And that's all very well, but you could equally draw it this way up, because this chart shows the people who do useful things in selling stuff and making stuff and collecting money and so on, who are supported by the managers, who are supported by the director. And it's quite useful to see who's supporting whom. There was a conversation about spread of management. How many subordinates do we think a manager can manage? I was on a management training course, and the lecturer said, the general assumption is that people can't really manage and support more than six reportees. And there was a know-all at the back who said, well, I've got 15 reportees and I don't seem to have any problem. And the lecturer said, well, Jesus chose 12 and he made a mistake with one. So what makes you so much better than him? So I think if it's more than six, you're probably not supporting them properly. Each member of the team has two roles. There's a functional role, i.e. salespeople sell and production people produce. And there's a social role in the team dynamics. And if you represent these as orthogonal axes, it helps you remember that that they are mutually independent. There's no reason why someone who is brilliant at writing software should also be brilliant at team coordination. You might almost say there's an opposite correlation. One joke. You know the definition of an extrovert software writer? They look at your shoes. There's no reason why anybody should be good at both. And in the team, you need to cover all the functional needs, obviously, but you also need to have enough social skills to cover all the social needs. In an hour and 40 minutes, I'm going to be singing with seven of my friends. I do this every Tuesday night. There's eight of us sing together. We've been doing it for 22 years. And some of my friends are good singers and okay music readers. And some are good readers and okay singers. Some are good at both, but a bit difficult to work with. And some of them are sort of okay as musicians, but really good at defusing fights. So we have the social and the functional capabilities on orthogonal axis. The point is that between us, we cover the functional, you know, we've got some people who sing high and some people who sing low and some people who are good readers and some people who are adequate readers, but also the sociology. And exactly the same happens in the company management meeting. You'll have people around a table and some will be brilliant at doing what they do and a bit spiky, and some will be quite good at stopping people fighting, and you do need both of these covered. I felt I should say a bit about matrix management. That hierarchical system that I drew before contrasts with the matrix system where you have a sales manager, a design manager, a production manager, a shipping manager, and then on a different axis you have product managers. And when it's like this, the functional managers rule and allow the product managers access to their resources. Another way of drawing this is to rotate it and have the products at the top and the salespeople down the side. In this company, the product managers rule and they employ bits of the function. And the design manager only gets to stay in work if enough of the product managers want something designing. Now, of course, both of these are oversimplifications, because you can either have the functions at the top or you can have the products at the top, or you can rotate the thing. Quite often there's a balance of power between the function managers and the product managers, and the matrix can rotate. But it is crucial that you, as the leader of this thing, understand the power structure and how you can optimize it. In real life, however hierarchical the staff charts, there's always a deal of horse trading. So really, all organisations are matrices to a greater or lesser extent. In other words, that organisation chart I drew is a simplification of real life. Shared resources like shared toys are always a management challenge, so the leader, i.e. you, needs to be able to set up a structure that works, then run it. And if you can't run it, you need to change it. There's been lots of people who've developed an idea of different team roles. I won't go into this in any detail, but these are the Belbin ones. So, for example, number two, a resource investigator is the person in the team who goes outside looking for new stuff, new products, new techniques, new suppliers, and so on. Shaper is usually the chief executive who shapes the company. Team worker, for example, is the person who is really good at stopping fights, and so on. Now, if you've got six people in your team and you want to know how the team looks, you can stick these characteristics around the edge of a circle and you can put where you think one of your members of staff is, and then you can put where you think another member of staff is, and then if you add all this lot together you can see how your team's looking. For example, if you've got a whole bunch of extroverts in your team, you probably haven't got enough on the number six team worker, and that means your team will spend a lot of time fighting with itself. I mean, you see this a lot when people recruit top people. They get the best designer and the best production person, and the team just blows up. They did a really cruel experiment in one of the business schools where they actually characterised a bunch of MBA students, and of course they're already a self-selecting sample, and put them in a team. And it was absolutely ineffective because each of them was leading the team. You can see it every week on The Apprentice if you like that sort of thing. You've got this in the notes, but I just want to point out that for each role there are strengths and weaknesses. And the one I'll draw you to is the team worker, because you might think that the team worker is a universal asset. So the team worker supports team member strengths, underpins their shortcomings, improves internal communication, generates team spirits, everybody's friend. And of course the strength is their humility, flexibility, popularity, distaste for friction and competition. But the weakness is that if they're underemployed, they will go out of their way to create a crisis for them to resolve. So they tend to gossip. Did you know what he said about you? All that stuff. So there are strengths and weaknesses in each of these. So watch it. Now, I mentioned that I'd end up talking about how you influence that which you don't control. And this, of course, is important with insiders as well as with outsiders. The first thing is to invest in the relationship. Remember my friend going across the Atlantic once a month when he wasn't having a crisis. And that, of course, means understanding their priorities, not yours. Now, it's difficult to say you must understand your banker's priorities in the present climate. But I think if you want your banker to be an asset to your company, you do have to understand your banker's priorities. And align your interests with theirs. So why is it going to be good for my company's bank if they lend me 50,000 quid? Well, unless I can make that case, my chances of getting the 50 grand is less. Active listening. I can't spend too long on active listening, but what it means is not turning your brain off while the other person's talking. Go and see them when there's no overt agenda. Remember, concert pianist does most of his playing when nobody's listening. Do the communicating when there isn't a crisis, so that when there is one, you've already got the channels open. An amateur musician will practice and practice until they get it right. A professional musician practices until they can't get it wrong. We want to create professional managers, so really you need to practice till you can't get it wrong. I made this slide when I first was running ISIS Innovation because we recruited some people who found it very difficult to work with this university. I can't think why. But in fact, it's generally applicable to you working with any large organisation over which you've got no control, only influence. And I suggest you think of the university or this large organisation as an elephant to which you're connected with a thin rubber band. And my recommendation is that you walk along with the elephant in whichever direction the elephant's going until it gets used to you. At that point, you can start to pull gently on your rubber band. But if you pull too hard or too suddenly, you'll break your rubber band and have no further influence over the elephant. Now, this is the case if you're talking to local government, if you're talking to your financiers, if you're talking to the university. Any big organisation which has got a much greater mass than you that you're trying to control by influence, this walking with the elephant, reworded into management speak, is building up your influence with the elephant. But don't think you'll ever have complete control, because you won't. Thank you for your attention.